Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Steve Scott and Stephanie Collins. Now the drill. We're recording on Thursday morning. So I was going to open up, and I will continue to do that, about Project 2025, because we have a number of installments that we need to do. But someone sent me a quote from Joseph Heller's Catch 22 this morning. I just have to read it to you because it's so damn prescient. It was miraculous. It was almost no trick at all. He saw it to turn vice into virtue, slander into truth, impotence into abstinence, arrogance into humility, plunder into philanthropy, thievery into honor, blasphemy into wisdom, brutality into patriotism, and sadism into justice. Anybody could do it. It required no brains at all. It merely required no character. I think that should be a billboard all over the United States with a picture of Donald Trump behind it. It merely required no character. So we've been doing certain installments about Project 2025. We have been interviewing Ann Nelson once a week. She wrote a fabulous piece about Project 2025 at the Washington Spectator, and that's entitled The Latest Plot Against America. And even though we have her on for a full half hour, I've been literally taking her remarkable piece from the Spectator and literally breaking it down into chunks and starting most of my shows by reading it. We're now up to installment number 5. And this is what she points out. Project 2025 is actually the opening salvo of the 2025 Presidential Transition Project. The comprehensive 900-page playbook was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by over 100 partner organizations. It's actually officially entitled Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. It lays out specifics for hundreds of policy objectives affecting every area of public life, from women and the LGBTQ populations to environmental regulations to the concentration of power in the executive branch to promote an authoritarian regime. Here is the 4th of 10 things you need to know about Project 2025. This is under what's called the Principal Policy Initiatives. Climate, Environment, and Energy. Recommendations regarding energy, climate, and environment are dispersed among a number of chapters. The authors of these chapters are telling. The lead author for the chapter considering the Department of Energy is Bernard McNamee, a former member of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under the Trump administration, an advisor to Ted Cruz, oh, of course, and a member of the Federalist Society. The lead author for the chapter on the Environmental Protection Agency served in the agency under Scott Pruitt, the former energy industry lobbyist who served as EPA administrator under, of course, Donald Trump, and resigned under a cloud of ethics scandals and charges of gross mismanagement. Plan 2025's recommendations on climate and energy would withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, expand fossil fuel drilling and consumption, and also include, shock, rollbacks. A new administration must immediately roll back Biden's order, reinstate the Trump-era energy dominance agenda, rescind Department of the Interior Secretarial Order 3398 on protecting public health and restoring science to tackle the climate crisis, and review all regulations, orders, guidance, documents, policies, and similar actions made in compliance with that order. I could go on and on and on, but you can just imagine what's in here. And I think every single time I read this, you need to take notes. You don't have to read the 900-page tome. We are your cliff notes for Project 2025. It is a horrific document, and we don't have to wait for Donald Trump to get elected, everyone. We're already seeing its implementation in places like Texas, like Iowa, like Oklahoma, like Florida. So if you want to understand what it plans to do, just start exhibiting what's happening in those states, and you will understand there are following, you know, verse and line. So given the fact that we're talking Texas, we know that if it's Friday, it must be Texas. We're being joined by Harvey Kronberg. He is the publisher of the Quorum Report. I want to welcome Harvey back to the program. There's so much that we have to talk about, Harvey, but I do have to ask a quick question. I did see someone finally beginning to suggest, could Abbott be Trump's VP pick? And I thought about that, and I just have one question for you, and that is, if he was, would Governor Abbott have to step down, or could he actually occupy both seats at the same time?
Well, the short answer is he probably wouldn't be the pick because he's in a wheelchair. And as you may recall, the former president doesn't like people in wheelchairs. They're losers.
Great point.
But the second reason is that he's actually more notorious on the border now. He's upstaged Trump on the border, and nobody upstages Trump. But as you may know, our lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, is close to Trump. He's been advocating for it. He's keeps proposing it. But most of us think it's either going to be an African American or a woman. But we do believe that he, if Trump were to win, he's going to be tapped for the to go to Washington. As far as running as vice president, it's a free ride. He gets to stay as governor. So,
Okay, that was my question. I think my understanding is, having talked to Scott over the years, is that Greg Abbott would like to be on the Supreme Court. Is that your understanding as well?
yeah, no, but he's too old now. He's closing in on 70, so
Oh yeah, he is too old. He's not. He's got to be 40. He's got to be 42. He's
exactly.
got to be able to be there for at least 40 years. You're
So he's
absolutely
most
right.
most frequently mentioned in terms of Homeland Security or AG.
Okay, good. Thanks for,
He's a former Trump
I
aide
needed
too.
that little fill in here. So there's a couple of things I want to talk about, and you mentioned what's happening now with the list of demands for the new speaker in the Texas House. And I guess we're going to start with the first question. Does Dade Phelan win his runoff, number one? And if he does he win the election, which I assume he would he really want to be there if he's not speaker?
All very good questions, and the conventional wisdom is that he probably isn't going to win. But remember he was 10 points up until Donald Trump came out and blistered him, and that was a last minute endorsement of his opponent, who's not a very effective person. But at that moment, Phelan dropped by 15 points.
Wow.
Now that's already baked into the cake. There's no surprise announcement. He may come back and pound on him, but remember that Trump is not on on the ballot this time. And the institutional, the commercial, the institutional, the Chamber of Commerce, the teachers have all been awakened to the possibility they're about to lose a speaker. And there's a it, it's not although there's a Club for Growth that's spending $1 million in Beaumont on TV trying to maneuver.
Incredible,
Yes.
incredible.
Yeah, and that's a very relatively inexpensive market. It's a very inexpensive market. The odds are the conventional wisdom here is that he isn't going to make it, but and that his opponents are circulating a poll right now says it's 60-40 against him. But
Wow.
I don't necessarily believe it. I think that commercial Beaumont area has awakened to the fact that. That they're about to lose a once in a lifetime probability, a possibility. We'll see.
Wow.
Now the question
Yeah.
is, does he if he is not the speaker? First of all, I think he will be the speaker if he survives. But if
Really? Huh. Okay. That's an interesting. I assumed immediately, even if he won, that they had taken away so many of the sort of anti-voucher Republicans that would win in November, that Dade Phelan would have a great difficulty sort of, maintaining his position. But you think he has a lot of built-in support just because he's been a fairly effective speaker.
Yes, well, and also, unlike Washington, it's not automatic for Democrats to vote against a Republican speaker. The last thing we want in te well, rational people who actually want policy made in Texas, the last thing we want is the Republicans inside their own caucus to pick to singularly pick the speaker. And the caucus has, I mean, we're in civil war here in Texas in the Republican Party. So it will be, if history is any guide, and this is long established, the minority party ends up being the decisive votes in whoever the speaker is. So when the
Wow.
Democrats were in charge, it was a race to get Republican votes. And when the Republicans were in charge, it was also a race to get Democratic votes. I also, as I've told you before, I do believe that Democrats are going to gain in the House this time, and which gives them an even stronger position. But there's this thing that's going on trying to emulate the Mike Johnson, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz melodrama here in Texas. If we end up, if the caucus ends up, were to pick the speaker, let's just say my guess is there's going to be 80 Republicans and 70 Democrats. That means if it's up to the caucus singularly, 41 members of the Texas legislature will pick the next speaker. And they'll be about as secure as Mike Johnson is right now.
Right.
That we've got the signatories on this contract on Texas is
Yeah.
contract for Texas, but contract on Texas. The signatories are mostly freshmen who would have been irrelevant anyway.
Yeah.
There's only four incumbents on that list right now, and they're so marginalized. The newbies that signed that will be likely will be coming. Don't know that they've just made themselves the marginalized caucus.
So let me play this back to you. So what I'm hearing from you is, if Dade Phelan wins Dade Phelan will probably be speaker. He will be speaker not necessarily because he gets the vast majority of Republicans to support him, but he does get a significant number of Republicans plus the Democrats. And part of the reason why the Democrats would absolutely want Dade Phelan as the next speaker is that Dade Phelan is going to continue to commit to the understanding that you've had historically in Texas that both Republicans and Democrats can chair committees. And my understanding is that if the Republicans pick their own speaker and it's not Dade, whoever they pick for speaker will not allow Democrats to be chairman. So if the Democrats gain more seats, if the Democrats don't want to be suicidal, which I know they don't, they do want to have that power of chairmanship, then Dade Phelan is like a win-win-win for them because they get someone who they have a history with, they get someone who will continue to appoint them as the chair. And I do have to ask this question. I understand that Donald Trump did not endorse Dade Phelan, and you saw his numbers drop. How long, though, has he been the representative for his community? I mean, isn't there some sort of like institutional relationship baked in for him, not just with the business community in Beaumont, but that people go, I know this guy. Like, why am I going to like choose someone? Donald Trump doesn't even know either one of them, really.
Right.
So, like, why would I trust him on this decision? I can vote for Trump for president, but I'm not going to have him decide who's going to represent me in Texas.
Well, the Phelan family goes back five generations in Beaumont. They've all been wealthy. They are extraordinarily well known. Yeah. And well respected, and there's not a hospital opening or a school ribbon cutting that doesn't have some kind of Phelan influence in it. But remember, we've got this massive migration into Texas. I don't actually know how many new voters he's got, but the inflammation, obviously, the MAGA inflammation is he also problematically in redistricting he was too confident. He accepted two counties that would be hostile to him in this environment. So. The Beaumont County, Jefferson County went for Phelan. He's got two counties that, including Vidor, which was most notoriously known for Ku Klux Klan meetings.
Oh, jeez.
So.
It's unbelievable. I've been looking at, there's an article at the American Prospect. I don't know if you saw it, and it was called The Fascist State.
Yes.
And the article is about Texas.
Yes.
And the article, and I read a portion of it the other day, Harvey, as the beginning of my show, just because I've never seen anyone provide so much like magazine real estate to a conversation between a reporter and the author. And the reporter is being asked about what's happening for him as he's trying to cover politics in Texas and how it is basically impossible. It is driving him out. That there is no place. And even when he can't secure documents, for example, that should be public record, people keep saying, well, just contact the attorney general. He's like, why? What's the point? The attorney general will probably say, yeah, charge him even more. Don't send him the documents. He said, there's no safe place to talk honestly and cover honestly what I'm doing. And that to me was just, it was such a sad commentary about Texas. And then when you look at what's going on with the abortion, then you look at what's going on with the border, then you look at all the things that are going on with the vouchers, that's something that nobody wants, especially rural Texans, but it may be shoved down their throats. It just seems that, you know, Texas may not be ripe for change, but it's ripe to break. That's what I feel. I feel like you're breaking it. You're not changing it. And that's not good for anyone. So I just thought about this. But then I saw this really hilarious piece about Ted Cruz. And we got to talk about Ted because Ted is so notorious, the most disliked U.S. senator. And we know that right now we're not even sure that he's doing the Senate job or whether he's basically more of a podcaster. I think that's really his occupation currently. But I saw a piece that was being pitched that Ted Cruz is pitching himself as the better bipartisan. And I'm like, I'm wetting my pants. I'm laughing so hard going,
yes.
Really? Who's he talking about being bipartisan with? You know, his wife? I'm just trying to figure this out. So how could he even say that with a straight face?
Well, he has co-authored a handful of bills with some Democratic senators, and he will quickly concede that he has been, shall we say, aggressive in his attack on the Obama and Biden administrations.
Oh, my God.
He's also remarkably false in half the things he says. As I pointed out previously, he's a known brand in Texas. We have a long history of having a showboat versus having a workhorse. Mm-hmm. For instance, when it was Phil Gramm and Kay Bailey Hutchison, none of the trade associations ever even thought to go to Phil Gramm because he was grandstanding on a national stage. The mechanic, the constituent service mechanic, was Kay Bailey Hutchison.
Right.
And it's the same kind of circumstance right now. If you want to get something done, of course, Cornyn's in a much better position as the senior senator and in leadership. but nobody goes to Ted Cruz. One quick anecdote that we published, God, when he was when Beto was challenging him, the rural West Texas community, remember, which is the bedrock of Republican
Of course.
support, the entire agriculture community, the Goat Herder Association, the Cattle Breeder Association, the Farm Bureau, the Southwest Cattle Breeders, they could not get a meeting with him. And it was about 8 weeks before the election, and they were getting ready to issue a press release. Every time they went to DC, all they could see was the staffer. And they never saw the senator and everyone out there. They were about to issue a press release condemning him for being unapproachable. He got wind of it and also realized he was in trouble. That was a close race. That was two ended up being a 2 or 3 point race.
With Beto,
Anyway, all
yes.
of a sudden, Ted Cruz is living in West Texas in 3 weeks before
A
early
phony.
voting. Yeah,
Oh,
yeah.
God. So what about Colin Allred? What is that's who's
Oh,
running again?
Allred.
Allred. So tell me a little bit about him. Does he have a chance?
Oh yeah, I think he's got a very clear chance. And
Okay.
Cruz is I may be an outlier on this, but I do not believe that abortion has yet been litigated in Texas. I've discussed previously how Beto was given a gift with Dobbs and did not run a single commercial on it. In fact, he did not believe in TV. There was an advocacy group called Mothers Against Greg Abbott, which were a legitimate grassroots seven started out as seven women around a kitchen table.
Right.
He raised a few million dollars, ran attack ads against Abbott on abortion, and within a week, according to Abbott's internal numbers, they cut Abbott's lead in half.
Oh
And of
my
course,
God.
Beto was too full of himself to go on TV and punch. And if you're not going to go on TV and punch, why give a guy $60 million in a place like Texas?
But
So
Colin
having
will punch.
I think he's already overhandled by the Washington crowd. And his biggest exposure is he's going to be timid and inaccessible. But this is ultimately going to be an air war. They don't have to brand Ted Cruz. And did a column where the headline at one point was Ted Cruz running for Senate away from Winter Storm Uri and away from Texas Supreme Court decision
Yeah.
requiring a woman to go to another. It was more terse, but he
Yeah.
has yet to issue a statement, by the way, on the Texas Supreme Court. Requiring a woman to leave the state for health care.
Oh my, but all you need is a bus ticket. I heard that on Fox. I heard that on Fox. Oh, it's abortion. It's no big deal. If your state won't do it here, you just get a bus ticket. And
Well,
I'm
I
thinking,
can tell you
Texas,
the
in Texas, they can arrest the bus driver. I just
yes.
want to remind everyone they can arrest the bus driver. So I'm not sure a bus
And
ticket will
so,
work. Oh, God.
just to remind folks, it's farther from Austin to El Paso than El Paso to Los Angeles. So.
Oh my God. So, well, let me just say something interesting. I think you need to repeat what you just said, that Beto never ran on Dobbs, never ran on abortion. And that's really important because that actually hasn't trickled down to like the MSNBC, CNN crowd, because they talk about why Beto lost and that abortion was on the table, but he never used it. And the
No.
fact that it was there and not being used meant it wasn't available to him because he made that decision and that choice. And so they're misreading what happened with Beto and Ted. And I do think that abortion is going to become more and more provocative. What just happened in Arizona has everybody apoplectic. And I just posted something the other day on my Facebook page, something to the effect of, well, in Arizona, if they're going to go back to like the mid-1800s and reimplement the law about abortion, what's going to make them stop at slavery? I mean, because even though it was a territory, the Confederates brought a lot of slaves into Arizona, and that was perfectly fine. So if it's perfectly fine then, it'll be perfectly fine with the Arizona Supreme Court. Oh my God, this is just
Well, we
horrifying.
had, I think it was The Atlantic had a wonderful story about Senate Bill 8 and Ann Johnson, who is an up-and-comer from Houston, an extraordinary state rep, Democratic state rep.
Yeah.
They had the author of the anti-abortion bill is even conceding that it might have been too extreme. But when they went to create some exceptions, she started out, and she represents the Houston Medical Center, which is
Right,
this
right.
enormous medical facility. They started out with, I think, 13 items that pretty much everybody agreed with philosophically, except for the right to life groups. And they ended up at finally passing two exceptions, neither one
Oh
of
my
which
God. Oh
material.
my God. That, I mean,
So.
again, that you almost need to create these sort of little documentary ads. so people can see it. That people are so stupid. You're talking about being overhandled. I hate overhandling. And in some ways, we need to be more powerful. We need to be more punchy, and we need to be more aggressive. We have to call it as we see it. No more cloaked terms. No more, oh, well, they tried. No, they didn't.
Yeah.
You know, they screwed you. They didn't try. All right. Last but not least, this
One
one.
last thing about Allred, and that is he
Okay.
actually is my he has worked across the aisle.
Yes,
And
he's
he
the most bipartisan, I think, congressman probably in Washington. So, you know, when that's why Ted Cruz is picking up the bipartisan line,
Right.
because he knows that he can't run on it, but he knows that that's exactly what Allred's going to do.
And you can see what his polling is showing him.
Oh, of course, of course. All right,
Yes.
so now explain this to me. The Texas AG, Ken Paxton, is suing Harris County to block a program that would give cash to poorest households. The program would give roughly 1,900 household payments of $500 for 18 months with no string attached. This is amazing. Paxton calls it, are you ready for this? Plainly unconstitutional. Like the man wouldn't even know the Constitution if it hit him in the head. So I'm just trying to figure out what chutzpah, and does he have a shot? And do you have to go to the Texas Supreme Court about this? Is that where we go?
I'm not exactly, I haven't read the filing, so I don't know what the legal
Okay.
course is going to be, but I can tell you that Ken Paxton, remember, is the same guy that went to federal court to try and decertify the elections of four other states, not even
Yeah.
his own. So
Oh.
when he says unconstitutional, it's obviously a term of art. He had obviously no standing in that pursuit. And right now, essentially, he's building a campaign against John Cornyn to run for United States Senate. So any gratuitous headline that he can throw up, whether it goes to completion or not, must be taken seriously. Plus, you got to remember that he was successful in taking out the three Supreme, excuse me, Court of Appeals judges who accurately said that there is no power in the Constitution. Again, we're back to that pesky Constitution, that there is no power in the Constitution for the Attorney General to initiate criminal proceedings for anything, much less voter fraud. It has to come from a district attorney or a grand jury, and then it can go up the food chain, but he cannot initiate it. So they did rule correctly. He got ticked off because he wanted to start initiating these gratuitous voter fraud cases. None of less than 1% has ever, been successfully prosecuted.
Unbelievable.
But the judicial system is a little afraid, obviously, having watched him successfully take out these three appeals court judges.
Oh God, this is like such a bad movie. All right, last but not least, I posted this on my Facebook page this morning from the Houston Chronicle. Misleading state-funded ads are no remedy for the cruelty of Texas abortion ban. They are running these billboards that talk about this. This is what the billboard says. You see a picture of this beautiful woman, and she says, I'm in control of an unplanned pregnancy. And where does the billboard send you? To the modernadoptionplans.org. Oh my God, the state is funding this. It is a lie. It is a lie. And I'm looking at this and they're promoting a lie as if this is going to dull the truth. I want to have like an ad like this, a billboard, and then I want to buy the billboard right next to it with my middle fingers up in stereo and going, you want to know about the truth about an unplanned pregnancy? Talk to me. Oh my
your
God, these are
viewers can't, I mean,
unbelievable.
your listeners can't see it, but I've got a splint on my hand. I thought they were originally just going to splint my middle finger, which was would have
That
been
would have
the
been
perfect
great.
accoutrement for my Twitter feed, but.
Oh, it's just, it says there is little evidence that adoption is the answer for women with unplanned pregnancies now that Texas has banned abortions. Yet an aggressive statewide adoption marketing campaign targeting low-income, single Black and Hispanic girls and women would have you believe otherwise. I saw this and I'm like, this is even more disgusting. This is, remember, you're the state with the highest percentage of uninsured people in America. Okay? You
And
didn't expand Medicaid. Pardon me?
one of the highest maternal fortality states too.
So even without getting rid of abortion, it was really a health risk to have a baby in Texas. I just want people to understand it. And now we not only know that they're basically, you know, preventing women from getting an abortion, they're trying to make a mifepristone something that's not available. And I want to remind mifepristone, which is the abortion drug, that it is actually safer than Tylenol. Okay? It is safer than aspirin. You know, it's like so amazing here. And yet look what they are doing by appealing to Black and Hispanic women. And I really do think that if there's a fight to be made, I think we need to have the billboard fight, because I think we need to like stick it right to them, because you can't avert your eyes.
There's just to bring us back to the beginning of the conversation, ironically, Dade Phelan, the speaker, is a very, very conservative individual, but he put his personal prestige last session behind a Democrat authored bill that extended postpartum Medicaid care for a year
Wow.
after birth, which was revolutionary here in Texas. So as
Wow.
conservative as he may be, and frankly, all these people that are attacking him, you ask him, what conservative agenda did he derail? Well, they didn't, none of them have an answer.
Yeah, of
But this little bit
course.
of humanity that broke through has been
Yeah.
nationally
Well, being
recognized.
human and being MAGA, I'm not sure they're on the same plane. Anyway, if it is Friday, it must be Texas. If it's Texas, it's Harvey Kronberg. He is the publisher of the Quorum Report. All right, Harvey, have a great week and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Ciao. This, everyone, is the Friday edition of The Attitude. We will be right back. Stick around, folks.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. To think about the bilateral relationship between the United States at this moment is to ask a series of questions about patron-client relationships. What happens when a client facing a very strong national security threat, and let's just look at from October 7th on here because this has been true for longer, needs and gets support from the patron? What is the patron's role and responsibility there, and what is the client's role and responsibility there? What happens when the client then prosecutes that war in a way that is foolish, brutal, leads to far too many civilian casualties, and very damaging both for the client and the patron on the international stage? What happens further when the leader of that client state destabilizes his own country through his foolish, undemocratic decisions? What happens further when the leader of that client state seeks to destabilize the patron state by trying to do what he can, let's be specific here, to make sure Donald Trump is the next president of the United States? And furthermore, what happens, as we are seeing now, when the client tries to drag the patron into a larger regional conflict? It is possible and indeed essential to both understand Israel's need to defend itself and to believe the United States can play a role in that, and to understand just how badly Benjamin Netanyahu has poisoned this bilateral relationship, and to continue to support Netanyahu is extremely damaging for the United States as well as for Israel, and will lead to even more deaths in Gaza. And the patron has the right and the responsibility to try to do something about that. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute, or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. As you know, every Friday we hang out with Bill Curry. Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician. He has been a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut and a White House advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton. He was also the former head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Curry.
Great to be here. Thanks, Arnie.
And we always love hanging out with Robert Hockett. He is a professor at the Cornell Law School. His principal teaching and research and writing interests lie in the fields of organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in both their positive and normative, as well as their national and transnational dimensions. But this is my favorite line from his bio. His guiding concern in these fields is with the legal and institutional prerequisites to a just, prosperous, sustainable economic order. Let me welcome Robert Hockett back to the program. Thanks for doing this, Robert.
Thanks, Arnie. Great to be with you again, and great to be with Bill, as always.
I had the honor and privilege of being able to share a church podium with William Sloan Coffin. It was at White Church at Dartmouth, and you know how they have those the two podiums up at the front, and Bill was at one, and Arnie was at the other, and it was the most remarkable thing I'd ever experienced, because I couldn't believe I was not only in his presence, but I was sharing this environment with him. And so every time I think about William Sloan Coffin, I always go back to one of his great quotes. And this is one that I think is so important to hold on to. And it says, "The world is too dangerous for anything but truth, and too small for anything but love." And I love it. It just hit me. So I wanted to sort of set the stage with that fabulous quote by William Sloan Coffin. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about Arizona. And I posted this on Facebook, and then I noticed that a number of people started to comment on it, and one of them was an attorney. And I posted the following. This is after the Arizona court came back and embraced a law from the mid-1800s that banned abortion. And I wrote, "Not just abortion. Confederate troops brought slaves into the Arizona territory. The Arizona Supreme Court would reinstate slavery if they had their way." And this was a comment on my Facebook page from an attorney. "My husband and I had this very same conversation last night. I asked, do they also want to reinstate the right to own and enslave people? Maybe people whom they think are drains on society? You know what else was a crime in 1846? Adultery. And all these effers do it, especially evangelicals and Republicans." So, I mean, what Arizona did was not surprising. And actually, if you spend any time reading Project 2025 and you begin to understand what their agenda is, what the Arizona Supreme Court did was probably, you know, one page of that 900-page tome. And that's our future. It's not about Arizona. It is about us. But I am hoping that people realize that this Dobbs decision has impacted so many other aspects of our life. We thought it was about abortion. And a lot of people said, oh, I'm too old, oh, I'll never have an abortion, or I'm a guy, or I'm a this. But it isn't just about this. It has opened Pandora's box about taking away so many rights. And I think we almost need to not only start with abortion, because it begins with the letter A, but go from A to Z, because they are beginning to target almost every aspect of what we embrace in a democratic society.
Yes, they're doing that. I look at these, we have two of these different laws from the 19th century being waved around in state and federal courts. And sympathetic to the idea that they shouldn't be given any operant effect after having been forgotten for so long. But I'm also sympathetic to the idea that it would be really good if we could have majorities in legislatures and in the Congress to repeal these laws. At the very least, we want to be able to stand on the principle that the democracy itself has decided otherwise. That is our North Star, self-governance and majority rule. I hope this will inspire. There's so many things to inspire democratic action in this election. And I agree with what you said about Dobbs. I'll just say one other thing about the abortion and Dobbs and all of it. And that is that all the stuff, the right doesn't believe in the right to privacy. And they say it can't be found in the Constitution. But the Constitution recognizes rights that arise previous to it. It would be more accurate, explicitly in two different sections. It would be more accurate to say that we inferred the Constitution from the right to privacy than to say, as William O. Douglas did, that we in Griswold v. Connecticut, that we infer the right to privacy from the Constitution. Without it, a constitutional society is impossible, and it embodies notions very truly fundamental. Fundamental as any to the birth of the country and to its identity. And so I hope that we can go out and explain a little bit more of that to people. This goes to the very heart of who we are. What we're defending here is our democracy and its process, and also in its character and the very character of the country. We'll see how good the Democrats get at that between now and November.
I always feel like so many of the politicians are so overhandled, Robert Hockett. And what I hear from Bill is that they go out and explain, and that's the thing that they're the most afraid of. Mm-hmm. That's what their consultants tell them not to do. Mm-hmm. And I think people are yearning for an explanation. Mm-hmm. They want a storyteller. They want someone to explain and hold their hand. They want someone to look them in the eyes and say, I understand why you're angry. I'm angry too. I understand why you're angry about not having access to healthcare. I'm angry too. But be able to sort of both spend the time, listen to people, talk to them, and tell them what it is that you believe, because I believe in my heart of hearts that so much of what we want to accomplish is what is so necessary to raise a family, to find a good job, to have a future, to be healthy. And if we could have these conversations and not run away from them, and I'll be really, one more thing, I remember having a Democratic candidate for Congress come on the air with me when I was doing talk television, and I would ask him a series of questions. And Robert Hockett, he would dance around every answer. He would never answer. And at the end of the half hour, he had this big smile on his face, like he had done so well, like a Cheshire cat, you know? And he looks at me and goes, how did I do? I said, you did so well in not answering any of my questions that you will never be back on this TV show ever again. Right. That was my answer. That was in the early 2000s. Yeah. I think it's gotten in some ways worse just when it needs to get so much better, Robert.
Yeah, I mean, there's it's hard to kind of walk through life these days without getting this kind of strange feeling of inhabiting a kind of irreal or non-real sort of world, as it were, right? Everything seems to be a kind of hologram of some sort, right? Nothing feels like it's actually what it is. It all feels as though it's generated, whether it be generated by AI, generated by sort of spin, generated by social media chatter that is itself sort of seeded and sort of created or projected by various operatives who are trying to sort of determine the shapes of our minds and thereby determine the shapes of our spending decisions as well as our voting decisions. And it seems to me, against that backdrop, that overhandledness on the part of politicians and, you know, kind of focus grouping and spinning by politicians is in effect just part of that same tapestry, right? It's a kind of generated irreality or pseudo reality. And for that very reason, I think people are often highly sort of relieved. I guess they experience a sense of relief on those rare occasions where some political figure doesn't seem to be handled, but seems to be saying what she or he actually thinks or believes. I think another thing that makes that all the more valuable seeming is just its rarity, right? In general, the rarer something is, the more sort of valuable it's perceived, at least if it's something that we think of as a good thing. And for that very reason, I think there's just this kind of longing for anything that sort of smacks of reality rather than of something that's just been generated hologrammatically by, again, AI or social media or some sort of media complex or what have you. And it's tempting for me even to think that some of these strange retrograde moves that are being taken by certain legislators and certain courts, most recently in Arizona, might themselves almost be partly a product of that, in the sense that, you know, if you suddenly, you know, backtrack to, you know, basically telling women that they have no more rights than they did in 1864, the sheer shock value of that perhaps conveys a sense of a kind of visceral reality that maybe in some subliminal way appeals to some of these people, maybe just because they're, again, seeking a sense of relief from this generalized impression that everything is generated. Everything is, again, a kind of hologram. I don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating here, but I'm just wondering if there's a kind of almost a psychological need for greater and greater extremity just because of the sort of dull lifelessness of this weird generated reality that we all seem to be inhabiting these days.
Oh, God. I just wake up in the middle of the night and I just shake. I mean, that's what happens. And then I look at what happened with Arizona, Bill, and I had posted this on my Facebook page just the other day, and I was trying to figure out who Donald Trump is. And I decided, I know who Donald Trump is. You know who he is? He's an amoeba. And I said, Donald is an amoeba. An amoeba has a remarkable ability to alter its shape according to the surface on which it's present, and sometimes can even eat your brain. And then I'm like, whoa. And I thought he belonged to the species known as Homo sapien. And then my proof of concept with was the abortion decision. Donald Trump takes credit for Roe v. Wade reversal, said abortion restrictions should be decided by states. He attacks staunch anti-abortion conservatives, who he said were making it impossible for Republicans to win competitive races. Trump's abortion stance favors campaign politics over conservative principles. And then, of course, we get Arizona, and now he's completely apoplectic. It's like, now where does he go? I mean, in so many ways, what's happened with Arizona has made it so, so difficult. It was already difficult for conservatives to explain the abortion decision and how they're playing it out with IVF. And now I'm looking at what Arizona did. I mean, what ground do they have? Where are they going? I just think that this is just blown up in their face. It is not something in the neutral territory. It's something that is incredibly toxic. And now it's even toxic for Donald because he doesn't know what the H to do.
I pretty much agree with all of that. And let me just underscore, I do believe that the single issue of abortion has kept Democrats competitive, both in the last midterm and now in this presidential race. These are two critical national elections in a row in which we're in the game because of Dobbs and almost Dobbs alone. I'm not really any more optimistic about November than I was. That doesn't mean that I'm necessarily pessimistic. I don't feel like anything's moved. I see how issues like Dobbs, especially Dobbs, can arise and damage the Republicans. But I don't see anything that the Democrats are saying or doing proactively that moves them toward a sustainable majority. And it would be so easy to do, intellectually easy to figure out, politically hard to do, but for reasons that aren't clear, why we don't raise the minimum wage, why we don't have a public option, why we aren't standing up to corruption, why we aren't standing up for the distribution of income, power, wealth, and opportunity in a more democratic way than we have with the Democratic Party. And the only answer, I think, is our own corruption by our donors. It's twofold. It's how you raise the money. You become mortgaged to the interest, really, you become mortgaged to the past by being mortgaged to the economic status quo. And then it's how you spend the money. And we've talked a lot about this, but it's, you know, consultants, everybody's over-lawyered, everybody's over-polled, everybody's over-consulted, everybody's told to stay off the issues that are difficult and just move on to the issues that are easy for you whenever you're talking in a debate, in an interview, in a speech, anywhere. Right.
Anywhere.
And it's got to end. It has to end. And it's not just a matter of addressing things. First, the policies have to change. Policy precedes message. Mm-hmm. First, figure out what you believe and then how to tell people about it. Fix the problems in the policies. There are a half dozen, some of which are about shoring up weaknesses, immigration, and others, most, are about exploiting our strengths by committing to our own principles. I agree with both of you so much that the political debate has become so debased. It is just so empty and manipulative and vicious. You used to hear phrases that have passed out of frequent usage, at least, ad hominem. People would say when person attacked another, a person would get up on the phone, that's an ad hominem attack. No one says it anymore because almost all the attacks are ad hominem. So the phrase is
exactly.
Like, you can't just keep getting up and saying ad hominem every time somebody else opens his mouth. Plausible deniability is another one. You know, we used to hate the Nixon types for their plausible deniability strategies. But the deniability doesn't have to be plausible anymore. We've changed the nature of lying. Mm-hmm. Lying used to have to be clever. Now it only has to be stubborn and insistent.
That's a gift
of Trump. But it had been taking hold before that. We have to stand up and be an antidote to all of that, both substantively and in terms of message. If we don't do that, the election, we may still win the election against a criminal and mentally ill, palpably mentally ill criminal fascist with whom we're presently tied. We may edge out the weakest candidate we have ever or will faced or ever will, or we may not, but we'll be stuck here and a biannual fight with fascists.
I think this is a bottom-up election, not a top-down election. And I am looking at what people are concerned about at the bottom. And people are concerned about book bans and what's happening to public education and how vouchers are draining money out of their systems. They're looking at things not only like abortion, but they're looking at things like the minimum wage. They're beginning to understand that they want to make sure that their kid gets a free lunch and they don't have to be so poor and so hungry in order to get that free lunch. They're beginning to look at the cost of childcare. And they're not looking up, they're looking at their local official, they're looking at their state official. And I think if we're smart, that the Democrats always focus on Washington. They always focus on the Beltway. I want them to start focusing on me, okay? Remember how I sort of started this conversation that this is not an election about Joe Biden, this is an election about me, and it's where I live. And one of the reasons why the economy is not working for Joe Biden is that the economy that he's fixing isn't about me. So if I can't afford a place to live, I don't care what's going on with the GDP. If I can't afford healthcare, I don't care the fact that you brought down insulin, but I'm not on insulin. I need everything else but insulin. So all these things, you know, I'm looking at wages. I'm looking at daycare. I'm looking at what's happening to everything that touches my life. And unless I'm incredibly wealthy and I'm able to clip coupons and I'm so glad what's happening on Wall Street, I am looking at a struggle that can't pay for the basket of food that I have to pay for every month. I can't pay for the affordable housing that doesn't exist in my community. And I can't pay for the utilities that I have to use to order to keep my house electrified or warm. So I think part of the problem is we have to really focus on how people live and not on these economic numbers that don't touch people in the way that they live and exist.
Well, I think there are two challenges. I mean, I agree that that's what needs doing in a sense, Arnie, but there are two sort of obstacles that stand in the way of success in pursuing that sort of strategy. One is a sort of paradox. We can think of it as a sort of paradox generated by the need for deep structural reform, right? So that phrase became something of a shibboleth in the mouth of both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, but it was true, right? I mean, the problems that we've got now have been so long in the making, of such sort of lengthy vintage, that what needs doing now is much deeper than what used to need doing, or at least what seemed in the past to seem to need doing. But the paradox that presents us with is that virtually by definition, a deep structural change is one that only occurs over some length of time, right? In other words, the benefits of a deep structural change take a while to materialize. And so you're not actually going to realize how much better things are getting, at least immediately. It takes a while for those dividends, in effect, to pay out. And the problem, of course, is that the electoral cycle is too brief to allow for that. Right. So we have this kind of irony that Joe might be doing exactly what needs doing for the long-term health and cure of the economy, but that he might lose or fail to get re-election precisely because he's doing what needs doing, which is something that only pans out over time. The second, I think, obstacle goes back to this kind of sense of unreality or this hologrammatic sort of virtualness of people's realities these days. I very seldom agree with anything that Paul Krugman says, but it seems to me that one drum that he's been banging on lately is a kind of important drum, or it's a drum that kind of gets to something real. And that is, he notes that if you poll people who watch Fox News on the one hand, and then poll people who watch some more sane network on the other hand, and ask them, you know, what's the shape of the economy? How are things? You're going to see huge divergences, right? Everybody who's watching Fox thinks the economy is a disaster and a shambles. Everybody who watches perhaps some more sort of highly progressive media source might think similarly. And then somebody who watches a kind of mainstream, you know, kind of Clintonian Dem sort of network, say like MSNBC, might be saying, yeah, everything's more or less okay. Now, that might reflect differences in the demographics of the people who watch these things, but it could also reflect the reality that to some extent our perceptions are indeed colored by what we're told is the case and what we're told to think about what's out there. And so that makes it increasingly difficult, I think, to find out really how bad or good it really is for people right now in the short run. Right. I have no doubt that things are really difficult in the short run for lots and lots of people. But what I don't know is how to determine whether they're better on that particular dimension than they were 4 years ago or 2 years ago or 10 years ago. Right.
I don't process 4 years ago. I process now. And when I look at the cost of food up, you know, by 20 or 25%, I'm not happy. And for a regular person, I don't look at every single aspect of the economy, but I look at what I see every week when I go food shopping. Okay. That's a reinforcer, Robert. It's a reinforcer. And it's not a positive reinforcer. And I think that that's problematic. And also, the anger has been diverted. So now what we're angry about is if we don't see that, you know, our job hasn't, you know, increased its wages the way we are, or we whatever, we're told to blame the immigrant. Okay. We're told to blame the migrant. They're poisoning the blood of the country. And everyone has an immigration problem story. But I was just thinking about this the other day, and I think I may have told you this. So as I'm watching the bridge collapse in Baltimore, and I'm realizing who's going to rebuild the bridge? Mm. We're going to get the people. Okay. Let's be honest, Robert. We're going to get the people. We already know that they're spread thin with infrastructure projects all over the country because that's what we just funded. We already know that we have the lowest unemployment. We already know that if, you know, who's picking our food and who's working on our, you know, our roofs and who's doing whatever, for a lot of them, it's undocumented immigrants, okay? We don't want to acknowledge it, but that's the reality, okay? They haven't disappeared, but they have disappeared. So even if I wanted to say to people, we need to change our immigration policy, because if I could sort of go into a field and then point out all the undocumented that are pulling, that are basically picking your lettuce or picking your oranges. If I could go to a construction site and show you all the undocumented that are actually working on that construction site. If I can go into a nursing home and show you all the people that are undocumented that are working there, but I can't do that. They're like doubly invisible. Where they're essential to the economy. We absolutely need them. And what are we knowing? That the border and immigration is the most toxic and powerful topic for Republicans. And in some ways, it is the biggest lie. And yet it's so hard, Bill, to be able to say it is such a lie. I told you about after Katrina, they had these T-shirts that said FEMA, find every Mexican available to rebuild New Orleans. We need another FEMA T-shirt. It should say, find every migrant available. And then I want to sell them in Baltimore because that's how they're going to rebuild it. Otherwise, how are they going to find the people? But we can't even tell the true story, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, I've said before, my favorite conservative, Angela Merkel, took on immigration issues in Europe and in Germany, and in part by explaining, this is who funds your retirement. This is who funds your social contract.
Yes.
This is whose labor will keep our economy growing. I'm doing this in part out of a sense of social justice, but I'm doing this also because you need it. I still think that you have to ante up on the question of border security and on the simple position that we believe in immigration under the rule of law, and that's how you get into the debate. And then you can explain everything else and get everything else that we've asked for. According to all the polls, most Americans are actually pretty good-hearted on all the issues of citizenship for Dreamers and citizenship path for all the immigrants who've come in and all kinds of other issues. I think, though, in the end, and you know, so one thing that Robert said about, you know, Biden may be fixing the long term. I don't think he is. And I think that fix is much more in line with the things Robert's been writing about and for new economic models and really, you know, just looking at the systemic problems in the economy, many of which transcend or of our old defunct political categories. And sparking a new debate is important. I just still don't see that we're having that in the Democratic Party that we have right now at the top. That's our greatest weakness.
And it's the corruption of the money. I mean, at some point, Robert,
that's why we're not happy.
That's why we're not having it. At some point, I need to thank Bill Curry and Robert Hockett. But Robert, we interviewed a young reporter who wrote a book called Barons about looking at sort of the seven of the major agribusinesses that control our food commodities. You've got to read it. You've got to read it. But if we don't break them up, then guess what? You will always see an increase in the cost of food. And that will, again, underplay what Joe Biden wants to accomplish. And unfortunately, his head of agriculture is basically a child of the barons on so many levels. Anyway, let me thank our Friday edition guests. We've been talking with Bill Curry. He is a former politician and a lawyer and a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut, and Robert Hockett, who's a professor at Cornell Law School. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for doing this. This is the Friday edition. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You bet.